Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 18th of December. Our guest this hour has written a very interesting article in the December 09 issue of On Earth magazine. David Gessner is with us, and the article is titled Loving the West to Death, a story of drill rigs, mountain bikes, and the fight to save our last wild lands. David is the author of a number of books, including Sick of Nature and five other books of literary nonfiction. He teaches creative writing at the University of Carolina at Wilmington. And the article takes a look, well, as he writes early on, anybody who thinks that the past is past should fly to Denver and then head west, as he did in early October. And what he found was, you know, a number of different things. He found an ever-increasing number of natural gas wells. He also found a really booming tourist industry. And he looks at whether or not the environment is suffering or benefiting because of scenery sellers. Our phone number for you to join our conversation, I'm sure many of you have been to the parts of the West that he'll be talking about and have looked at a changed landscape in the West. How do we preserve open areas? What role the drilling of natural gas wells? What role tourists in keeping the part of the country beautiful and preserving these wild open spaces? Do they serve that purpose in any way whatsoever? We're going to welcome phone calls for David, as we always do for our guests. And our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Emails are welcome, talk@WPR.org. Hi, David. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Nice to have you here. Why don't you give us a map, an overview of where you went? You flew to Denver, and then where'd you go?
I flew into Denver. And I drove out, I-70 up into the mountains and saw some blazing yellow aspen, but also saw, anybody who's been out there recently saw the beetles are at work on the evergreens, so saw a lot of dead brown up in the mountains, too. But it was beautiful, and came down the other side on the western slope into Grand Junction and spent the night there, and that's where you really felt the kind of gas boom. I say in the article that I paid $220 for my hotel Exxon rates because Grand Junction in the last couple of years has had this, has been impacted by the great boom. Now, the way things change, one of the themes of the piece is Wallace Stegner talks about boom and bust cycles and how they've always cycled their way through the West.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that he mentions is how quickly things change. So, of course, between the traveling in October and writing the article and the price of gas falling, things have changed already since I was out there. And out of Grand Junction, I dropped down into Utah, and I said in the piece, this is my favorite drive in the country. It feels like you're going into some kind of crazy, trippy dream. And people who haven't been to this part of Utah, near Moab or Utah period, who just see it through car commercials, can't really imagine how intense it is to be in there in the red rock, and especially as you wind down along the Colorado River deeper and deeper. And so I ended up in Moab. Then I stayed at a ranch above Moab at a guy named Ken Slight's house, and he was the person that Ed Abbey based Seldom Seen Smith, his character from the Monkey Wrench Gang, on.
Mm-hmm.
And then down into New Mexico, Arizona, came back up to Boulder, went up to Laramie, Wyoming, to the big, big hypocritical environmentalist road trip. Used a lot of gas, I hate to say. And of course, in your introduction, you said, I'm from Wilmington, North Carolina. So, one of the, when you start expounding on this is this and this is that about a place and you're not from there, you're certainly open to attacks. In fact, I think one of the funny things in the West is how somebody who moved there in 91 will criticize somebody who moved there in 95.
Right.
So, but I had a my wife and I met when I lived in right outside of Boulder, Colorado, and we spent 7 years there. And at the time, I was so infatuated with the West, as a lot of us Easterners are, that I was pretty sure I was going to live there forever. And and moved for a pretty simple reason, a job.
Right. And North Carolina is not bad either.
It's not bad, but I'll tell you, when I was out there, I thought, driving along, I thought, not only would I love to get back out there, I have a 5-year-old daughter, get her back out there, but here's where some of the big environmental fights are, and a lot of my writing focuses on. And, you know, it's just, it's a big place, and it's, you know, you go there for the same reason we've always gone west, you know, that whole renewal, the feeling, you know, to go from high art to low, no offense to John Denver here, I think he says at the beginning of Rocky Mountain High, I was born in the summer of my 27th year. There's this, you know, this sense of rebirth you get in these places
right.
that I've experienced nowhere else.
You start the article with Wallace Stegner. Can you talk a little bit about how he has informed your feeling of the West?
Well, I'm just full of admiration. You know, there's always been this tension. I don't touch on this in the piece, but there's always been this tension between the literary West and the literary East. And I think it's encapsulated best by a former student of Stegner, Ed Abbey's, who I mentioned in the piece.
Mm-hmm.
Abbey was arguing with a friend of his from New York, and the New York friend said, the problem with you is you're a big fish in a small pond, and I'm a small fish in a big pond. And Abbey said, perfect. This guy thinks New York City is the big pond and the American West is the small one, you know. And there's always been this sense of these writers, Abbey and Stegner, Terry Tempest Williams, as being kind of regional, which is somewhat comical when you think of the size of the region compared to, you know, the city. But there's this template that Stegner had of this kind of Renaissance man who wrote histories and biographies, great biography of Bernard DeVoto, another Eastern Western writer, did all this great work in literature, started the Stanford Writing Program, and fought all these environmental battles. So it's really neat compared to some of our more purely literary figures to have these people who can do great work
right.
and get their hands dirty in these fights.
Right.
And Stegner really informed me, not just as a thinker about the West, but in terms of what I wanted to do with my, you know, life and career. But as a thinker, he's the one who really brought home the notion of this is a very dry place, and it's a very fragile place, and it's had uranium booms, and it's had silver booms, and tourism booms. And he put in a word for what he called the stickers versus the boomers, the people who actually would stay in a place and try to make it a community. In fact, a real interesting little twist is he actually says some good things about Mormons. You can say a lot of bad things that people do, but he said that contrary to the kind of cowboy image of the West, one thing the Mormons did fairly brilliantly is they shared. Not obviously they shared wives, let's not go there, but they also you know, shared in terms of working the land and irrigating.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Stegner was real good at taking Western cliches and kind of turning them over and saying, well, that's not exactly how it is. And in the piece, I use his description of an ideal Western town, which would have a university, a community, a few, you know, strong industries, and it would have also a local writer or two who talk about the town's tradition. I use that notion of this ideal Western town, kind of taking it to the modern West and saying, or the contemporary West and saying, you know, where is this place? Where is this kind of utopian place? And can we find it in the West right now?
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about drilling for a moment, because you talk about this. The West is growing faster than any region in the country. It's here you write that the cries of drill, baby, drill resound most loudly. And it's easy to wag a finger and say bad drillers, but as a former Lycra-clad mountain biker, you wonder where does our recreation culture fit into the West's overall economic environmental picture? Well, that takes us into two big areas, but let's start with this drill, baby, drill.
Okay. Well, you know, as far as the way I approach this piece, I'm more of an essayist than a journalist. You know, I did my share of research and phone calls and interviews, but really one of the questions I wanted to ask was a personal one. You know, how culpable am I? You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm just coming in as a tourist. And so originally the piece was going to be driven by this notion of, you know, are mountain bikers, hikers, recreators causing as much damage as, do we have a leg to stand on as far as criticizing?
Mm-hmm.
But pretty quickly, getting off the plane and traveling, and talking to some contacts, I saw that there was this bigger issue, which was, you know, since I'd left the West a decade ago, and during the Bush years, drilling had just taken off. And as one of my contacts, Liz Thomas, said to me, the real problem above I-70, which kind of cuts across the state, is drilling in Utah and around Grand Junction. Below it, it's off-road vehicles, but the drilling has gone out of control in the northern parts of the state. And one thing that's being done is claims are being sold even in wilderness areas. And once any equipment gets in there, the wilderness loses its wilderness designation, so it no longer can be protected as a wilderness area. So it's this kind of tricky thing where all these claims are being sold, even now as things are drying up. You probably know about the kind of 11th hour sale that you know Bush is staging this week, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Once they're sold, they're soiled in a way that does not allow for future wilderness protection. So it's another one of these trying to cram things in right at the end. And having been by far our worst environmental president, he's ending with a real, you know, a final party, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it everywhere. And what I wanted to do, though, was balance, you know, not be like black and white and obvious about it, balance things. And Rob Blyberg, who's the head of the Mesa Trust, who basically puts land in conservation trust for ranchers around Grand Junction, he cautioned me. He said, look, you know, if you were a local kid and you had a choice of working at a Burger King or making $120,000 a year working on an oil, you know, what would you do?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a good point.
Mm-hmm.
And then he flipped it around. And he said, on the other hand, don't be so quick to criticize the lycra-clad mountain bikers. A lot of those people come out here, they bike, they fall in love with the place, they move here, and then they work within the town government to conserve the place.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what I found was, it's easy to make cartoon figures out of these characters, you know, say the old crusty rancher who, you know, hates the newfangled folk and the newfangled folk who are drinking lattes, you know, and biking around in their lycra. But it just seemed more complicated than that.
Right. So how did you answer the question for yourself that you posed? How culpable am I?
Well, that's why it took 6,000 words to write the article. It was complicated. I mean, because, you do find that one of the things that leads to preservation of lands is the fact that there are parks and recreation around there that draws people who then save and conserve the land. So it's a pretty complicated formula, and I found that the piece, as I said, I'm an essayist more than a journalist. I didn't try to conclude emphatically. I tried to draw a bunch of different threads out.
Right.
I used my former hometown as an example, which is always a little bit, when you talk about Boulder, Colorado, there's always some touchiness among real Westerners because, it always wins Outside Magazine's Best Outdoor Town, and it also, I don't know if you remember Stephen King's The Stand, it's an old book of his. In that book, there's this apocalypse, and all the bad people go to Las Vegas who survived the apocalypse, and all the good go to Boulder, and I think a lot of people in Boulder think that's really how it is. And so there's a smugness to Boulder. You know, people don't want to use it as an example. But on the other hand, one thing they did about 30 years ago was save the land around the town and save the foothills and preserve it. And by that, they created this mecca that's a very vibrant economic model and has still, you know, even though it's crowded and there's sprawl around it, has these foothills, has these trails that really make it kind of a jewel in a lot of ways.
And very green community, isn't it?
Very green, and Forbes just called it America's smartest town because it has more PhDs and MFAs, which is actually an interesting part of the big economic puzzle. There's a great quote in by Ben Alexander. I'll see if I can find it here, where he basically says, oh, here it is. He said, it used to be that jobs led to migration. He's an economics professor in Bozeman, Montana. He said, it used to be that jobs led to migration. People went the way I went to North Carolina for my job. But what we see now is that the migration is the thing driving economic development. In other words, people will go to a town like Bozeman and say, this is beautiful. Boy, I wish I could live here.
Mm-hmm.
And more, people can live there, people who have kind of knowledge-based jobs and, you know, with the Internet, and they move there. And that, you know, that's kind of what's driving the economic growth of those places. Now, of course, the downside of that is you get crowding and you get people coming in. But I'm afraid, you know, that's one problem we're not going to be solving with the crush of population.
We're going to welcome phone calls for David. Our guest is the author of a very interesting piece in the December 2009 issue of On Earth, Loving the West to Death, a story of drill rigs, mountain bikes, and the fight to save our last wild lands. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Or you can send an email if you'd like. That address is talk@wpr.org. David is the author of Sick of Nature, and he's written a number of other books of literary nonfiction. He teaches creative writing at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington. Our lines are open for you at this very moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 800-486-8655, and you can also send an email. That address is talk@wpr.org. I think that some of us, and you write about this quite beautifully, David, think of a lot of the people who farm and ranch in this part of the country, fitting, as you say, a stereotype of conservative old-timers. But you talked with a lot of people and met many people who have a real inherent respect for the land and a deep concern for its future. And a lot of the people in that category are in it for the long haul.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I mentioned Rob Blyberg and the Mesa Trust, and he said, you hear a lot of people talking about love of place, but you've got these ranchers putting their land in trust forever.
Mm-hmm.
And show me a more, you know, more concrete, an emphatic show of love of place than that. You know, these people who could sell the land and, you know, be sipping, you know, pina coladas on a beach somewhere, mm-hmm, are sticking it out and keeping the land there, you know, forever. In fact, there's an interesting, you know, another complication is you're suddenly getting ranchers complaining about off-road vehicles.
Hmm.
There's one I quote who says it's starting to look like a scene from Mad Max.
Hmm.
And, you know, it's just not as simple as it seems. I mean, the central person above Moab who I talked to, I mentioned before, Ken Slight, who was the character whose character seldom seen Smith, who was called a Jack Mormon, meaning a half Mormon or an unpracticing Mormon by Ed Abbey. Ken was the real deal. He's 79 years old. It was about an 80 degree day, and he was wearing jeans and two dungaree shirts, and sat down with me and offered me a beer at 10 in the morning, which of course I happily accepted, and told me stories about growing up there and his slow evolution into, you know, an environmentalist. He was friends with Abby and was one of the first river guides. He would take Ed Abbey down the Colorado and the Green, and he said during the piece, look, I'm culpable too. You're talking about being culpable. I'm culpable too. I was advertising in my small way to get people to come on these river trips I gave, and Abby would write about these people. He'd be taking secret notes like a double agent. So we all have our uses for the land too. But I think the key is, you know, what Stegner in his famous Wilderness Letter said is, you know, there's a spiritual use. It's a spiritual resource too.
Yes, right.
To have this place, mm-hmm, this wild place where people don't go. And that's the thing that's really been invaded and impacted by the more recent, you know, proliferation of both the drilling and the off-road vehicles.
Yeah. And what are all the off-road vehicles doing there? What do you do with them?
They bomb along. You know, this is another place where I don't want to go. I don't want to do the cliche liberal finger wagging thing, because no one, none of the environmental groups there are saying, let's eliminate off-road vehicles. They're saying, let's zone the area, basically, and restrict some use. They only want to cut down about 1,500 miles of off-road vehicle route out of over 20,000 miles of route in the Moab area. And what you do is, you know, you come in towing, usually, your off-road vehicles behind your trailer. You get to a campsite, and, you know, you hop out on these things, and you bomb along on the trails. And one kind of insidious practice with these vehicles is the law says you can only ride them on a known road. The problem is, more and more, people are finding old uranium mining trails, GPSing them, taking a picture and saying, this is a road, and then they ride over it a couple times, and you see the tire tracks, and it's established as a road.
Mm-hmm.
So more and more these things are spreading. And people aren't suggesting eliminating them. They're suggesting creating pockets where they're not allowed. And that's, you know, that's changed dramatically in the last 8 years.
Let's go to
more and more has been allowed.
Phone calls for David. We start with Barbara from Spring Green. Hi, Barbara.
Hello.
Hi, Barbara.
I wondered if your author has heard of another author called Alexandra Fuller, who wrote an article in the New Yorker magazine all about the drilling and the effects it has on not only the landscape but the people that drill.
You know, out of literary jealousy and bitterness, I don't read the New Yorker. But but I'd love, you know, if you point me toward it, I'd love to read it. I know it's just about the most dangerous and health-affecting profession out there. And, you know, one thing I discovered as I talked to economics professors was it makes up a surprising, when we have an image of, you know, ranching and drilling as being this big part of the Western economy, it makes up a minuscule part of the economic picture. And, you know, and for that minuscule part has such large destructive consequences.
Mm-hmm. Right. What issue was it in, Barbara?
Well, it's been a year. She's from Jackson Hole, or that area, and she grew up in Africa, in Zimbabwe.
Hmm.
And her family was written up in a book called Let's Not Go to the Dogs.
Oh, yeah.
Have you read that?
No, I've heard great things about it.
Yeah,
I haven't read it.
It's great. And she was a daughter of the family that they talk about.
Yeah. And there's another great, more recent piece by Elizabeth Hightower, who writes for Outside Magazine, which is kind of a survey of all the drilling. As I mentioned, that wasn't going to be the original focus of the piece when I landed, but it just, you can't ignore it when you're out there right now. You can't.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you.
We go next to Teresa from Viroqua. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. I'm actually from Moab. We moved here a couple years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're doing
the
reverse migration.
Really?
I am. You know, I've got 7 kids and we're not Mormon, although I have a lot of dear friends in Moab who are Mormon. But the education system, once they get to college, is pretty tough if you're not Mormon. So we looked around, and Wisconsin's just got, you know, the best to offer as far as the state universities go. So we're here in cold Wisconsin, missing Moab terribly. But I had a couple comments and a question. I would highly recommend the Zephyr.
Oh, yeah, well, I'm going to talk about the Zephyr.
Yeah. Written by a former river runner in Moab.
Former local now, yes.
Yeah, and the High Country News out there, both of those are great, you know, kind of watchdog papers.
I stop on the trip at, you know, I used to be a political cartoonist for High Country News, and I stop on the trip and visit with the interns there and with the editors. Yeah.
Yeah.
What did you do in Moab?
Well, I did a little of this and a little of that, some mediation work and legal stuff. You know, we actually lived in Castle Valley, which, you know, there's just no more beautiful place on the planet than Castle Valley. Which
do you know Dave Early?
I do.
Yeah, he's an old friend.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, it's a great place, I think, but for kids it's kind of a tough place to grow up.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe when I'm older and less house full of kids, I'm like the old woman in the shoe. But you know, I wanted to comment on the jeeping situation, because I think if people haven't ever been out in the West, particularly in Moab, they have this week-long thing in spring break. It's called Jeep Safari.
Yeah.
And it is, I mean, you know, you hear about these spring breaks down in Palm Springs and down in Florida, you know, where you've got a bunch of topless girls running around. But what you have in Moab is just, you know, an unbelievable onslaught of these Jeeps and testosterone and
right.
alcohol and drugs.
A nice combination.
It
is insane. I mean, they're just crawling all over the place and rolling. And, I mean, it's really a dangerous territory to be doing some of this
yeah.
stuff. But the kind of raping that really that goes on for the
yeah.
land out there is just really kind of appalling. And I agree. It's not, you know, there's just responsible, conscious ways to engage in those kind of activities. And,
yeah.
And so it's hard to get it, though, if you haven't seen it. It's a nightmare. I wouldn't even go to town
yeah.
for a week.
You know, it's funny. A few things just come to mind when you say that. And one is Jim Stiles was my original contact, and he had just left. I've mentioned Ed Abbey a couple times, but for people who don't know, you know, he worked at Arches in the 50s and 60s. Arches is a beautiful park near Moab that's now very, you know, drive-through commercial. In fact, Abbey ranted against you know, what he called industrial tourism. And Jim Stiles was kind of in the Ed Abbey mode in terms of being a curmudgeon and being funny, and he's a great cartoonist too. And his paper, it's the Canyon County Zephyr, is that right? His kind of bully pulpit for attacking these lycra clad mountain bikers and the other kind of caricatures. There's actually mountain unicycling now in Moab, and there's people in aero RVs. And so Stiles liked the wildness of the place and didn't like these intruders. And he had just left to move to Australia the week before I landed there.
Oh, wow.
So he's looking for, you know, to recreate the old Utah in you know, down under.
Yeah.
But yeah, they, you know, they're all, basically what happened is Moab in the 50s briefly got up to a population of 9,000 because of the uranium boom. Then with the movement toward nuclear power and the end of the Cold War and the drying up of the uranium boom, the population plummeted and it looked like it was going to be impoverished. And just around that time, after a couple of years, an article came out in one of the first mountain biking magazines that said, there's this really cool place, Moab. And all of a sudden, the mountain bikers started descending,
yeah.
and the Chamber of Commerce got hold of it and said, hey, this is our rebirth. This is our new boom. And so they advertised for every sort of adventure thing in the world. And the adventurers all descend on there. And and Jim Stiles used to like to mock them before he left.
That's kind of sad, though, because that means he's kind of given up on Moab.
It is sad.
Yeah, my daughter.
It is sad.
Graduated from college, my oldest daughter, and she moved back to Moab, so she's living there. Oh, you know, working at the Peace Tree Juice Cafe with her college degree, but
yep.
you know,
I was just there.
She loves it, you know, and you have a lot of people like that. Who have their college degrees, and they just find their little niche, their way to do it. They run the rivers. They work
yep.
the tourist trade. But one of my big concerns and my question, I guess, for calling in was, what can be done, if anything, to stop this fire sale auction that's happening of the land around Arches? I mean, it's just criminal, and I don't know what can be done, if anything, but it breaks my heart to hear.
Well, obviously, you know, there are going to be a lot of lawyers involved. I mean, this plan for the BLM lands, the public lands around Moab, this, you know, in the last 4 months, these huge 2,000-page reports have come in that are kind of these 11th-hour attempts by the Bush administration to open up these lands to off-road vehicles and to drilling. And obviously, legal teams are trying to fight back until the new administration gets in. This week, Salazar was appointed as, you know, Interior, and it's going to be interesting to see where he comes down. On the one hand, he's got a great environmental record. On a lot of, on the other hand, he's got sympathy for, you know, the mining and ranching industries that are sometimes rubbing up against the other. So I don't know, you know, what can be done immediately. I've got to believe there's something deeply illegal in the last month of one's presidency to try to do what's being done right now.
Thank you so much for calling, Teresa. I didn't think we'd have anybody who was from Moab call into the show. It's a great thing about public radio.
Two other points on her point. One is, you know, in the desert, it's not the woods, it's not a meadow, it's not the mountains. There's cryptobiotic soil, which is a kind of living crust of lichen, algae, and mosses. And once you trample it, you know, you're essentially killing that land. So it is a very fragile landscape. And as far as one of the environmentalists I spoke to talked about the political situation and had a great line. He said, you know, the Republicans get in office and they instantly know their agenda and they set to it, you know, the drill, or whatever that agenda is. The Democrats get elected and it takes them 3 years to realize there's a Department of Interior. It seems that this time the Democrats are aware that the Department of Interior exists. So that's good news.
Thanks, Teresa. Tim is next from Kenosha. Hi, Tim.
Hello. Thank you, Kathleen. Appreciate your show. I really enjoy your guest's comments. I grew up in Grand Junction during the uranium, gas and oil shale boom. And your comments are right on. There's been a conflict between people coming in to Colorado versus the natives for as long as I can remember.
Yeah.
So that it just continues, and it breaks my heart to see what's going on out there. But I am optimistic, I guess, in regard to a lot of the conservancy that's going on.
Yeah.
And the new administration, hopefully they can do some things. But
let me jump in just for 1 second. We can, you know, I think in an odd way, Grand Junction is an example of a reason to be optimistic.
Right.
And I think so because it's opposes, I mean, originally founded as a, you know, as a boom and bust thing. And absolutely. Oil shale, as I say in the article, became, I don't know when you were there exactly, whether that was your period.
Yep.
During the shale. And all of a sudden, there was a day, I believe it's in the, I have it written down, but I believe it's, correct me if I'm wrong, in the 80s, maybe early 90s, where Exxon withdrew and said, we're not going to go after the oil shale. And all of a sudden, there were
like
empty hotels, and they were, they called it Black Wednesday. Yeah.
The town of Parachute, which was a brand new town, essentially, was abandoned.
Yeah. but then something interesting happened, and this goes back to the kind of Stegner notion of what a Western town can be. Actually, without the extractive industry, Grand Junction became, you know, its population went up to around 100,000, a little more. It became kind of a regional hub. You know, it had its airport. The schools got pretty good. Housing was affordable and fairly abundant. And it began to look like kind of a post boom and bust economy before the most recent boom, the natural gas boom.
Right.
And one interesting thing, talking to some people in Grand Junction, was they said things were going pretty well. And then with the flood of new people who were working in the oil fields or the natural gas fields, suddenly housing got tight and went through the roof because people were charging for the new people. And it kind of swamped what was becoming a fairly healthy economy. But I guess the optimistic thing for me is what was happening there without the reliance on boom and bust for a while.
Right.
And it was an interesting combination of, you know, of the ranchers nearby, of things like its own smaller, less tacky, overblown mountain biking industry that was in Fruta, you know, and
right.
Knowledge-based industry. So it was it's kind of an interesting town as far as hope for beyond boom and bust.
Right. Yeah, the housing industry is amazing. $300,000 mean price for a home in the area.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and in Moab, a lot of those houses are either second homes of people who don't live there. And,
right.
Is that true today?
Well, it seems like it's taking a long time. Huh. The things I read in the paper, there seems to be some kind of a lag time.
Goodness.
I'm trying to buy a house down here, and I'm not finding the prices falling as much as I'm told they are. So.
Thank you, Tim, so much for your call.
Thank you.
We're going to welcome more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We are talking with the author of a cover story of On Earth magazine for December, the winter, actually, of 2009. Loving the West to Death, Will Tourists, Bikers, and Gearheads Ruin the American Wilderness or Save It? And we have an email address, too, if you'd like to use that. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls for David. George is next from Chaseburg. Hi, George.
Hi.
Hi.
I know you've made reference to Edward Abbey quite a few times in this program, but I'd like to recommend a book called Desert Solitaire, which happens to do with his years as a park ranger at the Arches. And I guess I first thought of it when you were talking about driving over the western lands with all these machines. And in his book, Edward rants and raves about no one should be exploring the west and all devices of gasoline engines, and he includes snow machines and, you know,
right.
You know, it's amazing because normally one would think, I mean, I think he wrote the book in the early 60s, and it wasn't that prevalent then, but, and he was even angry that they were, in this book, he makes reference to engineers for the park department coming through and surveying to make a new road, so
right.
Through the industrial tourism, and I think that's the beginning of the industrial tourism chapter, but it's... He is sort of the Thoreau of the Southwest. I mean, I just love his stuff, and this is one of his better books. So.
Well, he's a great writer. As you know, you mentioned ranting and raving, and that's one of his favorite genres. But he also is very funny, and I think that's the disarming part. He can be waxing poetic about a beautiful mesa, and then all of a sudden tell a fart joke or something. And one of the things that makes him interesting. And I actually think he's like Thoreau in this, because one of my favorite moments with Thoreau, he's talking about divine, high ideas, and all of a sudden he sees a woodchuck, and he says, I'd like to grab and throttle it for the wildness it represented. So I love these contradictions, and Abbey is great at that.
I wanted to make reference to that, so I recommend it to anybody to read. It's a great book.
Thank you. He said, you know, the one mode of locomotion, you know, he recommends in public lands and parks is feet, you know, walking in. And, you know, just to get back to a second to the culpability thing, one of the places I stopped, one of the earlier callers mentioned High Country News. I stopped there, and I was asking some young interns who are young environmentalists about how they feel about magazines like Outside and Backpacker, especially when they come on with the covers that say, visit 10 wild places no one has ever been, you know, which is kind of horrifying. And you know, one of them started to kind of make fun of that sort of cover. And the other said, hold on, you know, I grew up in South Carolina, and I would have just been some jerk in an office, but I started reading those magazines when I was 13 or 14, and it was kind of a gateway drug for me. I ended up going west and becoming an environmentalist. So, you know, there's more, another complication. You know, if we don't spend time out in those wild places, how do we learn to value them? And sometimes we spend time by recreating out there. That's how it starts, you know, and then we say, wow, this is a beautiful place. It has value. It needs to be preserved. I love this place, and so I'll fight for it.
Right.
It's always easy to stereotype, but every time I talk to somebody, an example would be, I went up for kicks, and thought it would be right for the story, I went up to the Slick Rock Trail, which is the most famous mountain biking trail right above Moab, and I was getting my bike out of the car, and somebody came off on a motorcycle, and I remembered that it originally had been a dirt bike trail, a motorcycle trail, and so, but I still kind of reacted with reflexive environmental outrage. But then I said, you know, let's see what's going on here, and I walked up and I shook the guy's hand. And he actually was a big mountain biker as well as a motorcyclist. And he said he talks to other motorcyclists about trail etiquette. And, you know, and he believes that there's plenty of off-road trail already and that they should be happy with that and kind of restrict. So it was interesting to kind of scratch this guy's surface and see a little bit more. And actually, it turned out it was kind of interesting. He was an Olympic biathlete. He skied and shot, basically, so...
That's always struck me as one of the most unusual of Olympic sports.
Ride along gracefully.
Right. And then, I know. What is this? Here's an email for you. Here's my comment. We can talk about ways to share what's left of our open spaces, but the 800-pound gorilla is human overpopulation. Very few people are willing to take on this subject. Please ask your guest what his thoughts are on this topic.
Well, you know, that is. I think that's a great question. And that's exactly what I came in with saying. Like, really, so what? I mean, you can do all this other stuff, and it's going to be overpowered by numbers. But I believe his name is Thomas Michael Power. He's an economics professor at University of Montana. And he talked to me about it, and he said, well, okay, you're talking about world population. Look at the population trends, you know, that are pretty, you know, they're not so spiked in this country and in a lot of these areas. Now, it's true that the West is the highest growing part of the country, but, you know, it's hard to think in terms of dramatic overpopulation as you make the drive south from Moab into the Four Corners and you don't see a soul, you know, for miles and miles. And he said that in some ways the big cities like Denver and Phoenix serve an environmental purpose in that they're, in his words, ruined already, and they cluster population. So essentially, his picture of the West is these clusters of population in the big towns, but also in the smaller towns, and kind of like, particularly the smaller towns, kind of like outposts that are looking over kind of the public commons, which is the, you know, the public land. And if you did reverse the Bush trend and, you know, close down some of these spaces to everything but walking, or even in some places just, you know, completely close down, you would have clusters of population, of intense population, and you'd have, you know, spaces that could be preserved. And as Stegner said in his Wilderness Letter, even if you never go there, those spaces are important. They're, they're important spiritually, they're important to know they're there, to remind us that we're human animals.
Let's go to Ron from Sparta next. Hi, Ron.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thank you for allowing me on. 3 years ago, we had a hunting trip in northwest Colorado in the fall, in October, and we didn't take any off-road vehicles because the National Forest is restricted. No traffic with off-road vehicles. Right next to BLM land, it's located. And we're up at 8,200 feet, and we turned in numerous forerunners that were off in the national forest. But I think the staffing is so inadequate that they could not handle the, you know, the. But it really spoiled the. You could see the future erosion and all the problems that it's causing, and the trails that they're making that were non-existent before this happened.
Yeah, there's a couple of great points that you just made. One is, I think for 1.8 million acres in southern Utah, there's one staff member in charge of enforcement. And then for another 1.7, it's two. So they've got three people for, you know, 4 million acres almost. And how is that going to, how are you going to, you know, even if you could stop something. The other point is, I know it's coming off as if we're pointing fingers more at motorheads than, say, mountain bikers in this hour, but Moab did a survey where 7% of their recreators were off-road vehicles, but they had access to 81% of the public land. And it's just a simple fact that when you're in a machine, you're covering and potentially destroying a lot more land than you are by foot or even by bike. So, yeah, that's I mentioned Ken Slight, and he was having problems on his, you know, the LaSalles are up above, their snow-capped mountains above Moab, and he was having trouble with illegal logging because the BLM enforcement people weren't getting out there on the hill next to his, and he decided to take action. He was probably about 70 then, and he got on his horse and he rode up, and the horse kind of bucked, but he pulled it right up to the loggers, and he stayed there, and they called the cops, and the cops came, and he said he hoped he was going to get arrested, but he didn't. But they eventually got a BLM person in there to enforce. But I mean, that's the most dramatic measure you can think of, and to draw enforcement in. But so much of the land, you know, there's no way you'd ever catch somebody going illegally off.
What were you hunting there, Ron? Oh, Ron is gone. All right, let's go to. We'll probably have time for one more phone call. We're running short. Carl from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Carl.
Good morning, Kathleen. A topic near and dear to my heart. One of the things that happens with the Forest Service and the regulation of Western lands is that a very large amount of their budget and their effort is tied up in lawsuits, because environmental groups bring lawsuits protesting the all these incredible deregulations of the Bush administration, and they find themselves, you know, spending a lot of money and time and personnel on their defense of these things.
Yeah. Well, that's another interesting twist on the whole thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It is. Yeah.
It's you know, I just can't believe, though, given, you know, this type of spending, you know, we see in so many different areas, that they couldn't have two instead of one, you know, enforcement officers for the BLM land there, or three, you know.
It's just incredible, isn't it?
It's just, you know, when you think of, you know, 4 million acres, I mean, you're talking about, you know, I'm from Massachusetts. We barely have that in our state. So, you know, to think that you'd have a cop patrolling Massachusetts, you know, and,
right.
And so I think, you know, to some extent, I honestly don't know. You know better than I about that problem. But I just would think, in terms of prioritizing, if you value this land, you can afford.
Well, I think
four.
The actions of an ideologue.
Sorry, Carl. What did you say?
I think that the Bush administration actions reflect an ideological perspective.
And there's a really interesting thing about how they use that ideology to play in to kind of Western sentiment, which is playing up this notion of freedom and kind of, I say in the piece, like this yeehaw, don't tell us what to do attitude, when in fact those freedoms, say you give the off-roader a freedom, it's impacting hundreds of others' freedoms. It's impacting the, you know, or thousands of others' freedom. It's kind of a misconstrued notion of the kind of Western myth. I think at the end of the piece, I say, you know, we can take the cowboy myth of George W. Bush and turn it back into the cowboy myth of Teddy Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. You know, we can use this kind of, and maybe at this point in our evolution, rather than unrestrained freedom as an ideal, we can see the value in restraint, which isn't quite as sexy as freedom.
Mm-hmm. But thank you so much for your call, Carl. And thank you very much, David, for writing the piece and for being with us. We should also say the pictures are quite striking in the story, too, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're good. Thanks, David.
Yep.
David Gessner, our guest, and the piece is Loving the West to Death, a story of drill rigs, mountain bikes, and the fight to save our last wild lands. It is the cover story of On Earth, December 09, magazine. So. It's a good one. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. Thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for listening and for your calls, everybody. I'll be on vacation next week, celebrating the holidays with my family. And so I'll be with you again, when? A week from next Tuesday, close to the end of 2008, which is pretty amazing. So please sure and stay tuned. Next week we'll have a lot of great shows on the air. Veronica Rickard will be in for me. And then we'll be back the very last couple days of 2008. So we'll do some shows. I always get mushy this time of year. Skip the celebration. I just think about the world. Think about the future. Where have we been? Where are we going? Aren't I a lot of fun on New Year's Eve? At any rate, we'll have some of those kinds of shows of looking at the last year, which has been an extraordinary year. So that's coming up. Thanks for listening, everybody. It's a minute before 11 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.